This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It was back to school this week for students attending charter schools in North Carolina, and this year there are more of those schools than ever, 160, I believe, including two new online schools. Charter schools started here in 1996 and get their funding from the same pool of money from which traditional public schools get theirs, but they don't operate under the same state and local rules. That has raised questions of fairness and also questions about exactly how to judge the performance of these schools. Well, there are certainly successful charter schools. There have also been some failures, and that has raised another set of questions. Advocates say charter schools offer parents more choices and may push traditional public schools to improve due to the competition. But others say these schools suck money away from public schools, making it hard for them to improve. They also complain about the alleged lack of oversight that charter schools receive. Lawmakers in Raleigh have been debating a bill that would take oversight of charters away from the State Department of Public Instruction and create a separate office under the State Board of Education. And one Mecklenburg County lawmaker has suggested charters take over the state's lowest performing schools. Today, we take a closer look at some of the questions swirling around charter schools with Ann Doss-Helms, the longtime education reporter from the Charlotte Observer. She took a sabbatical from that beat last year, but she's back, and she's back on the program. Welcome.
Thanks. Good to be back on the beat and here.
Nice to see you. Cheryl Turner is director of Sugar Creek Charter School and a member of the Charter Advisory Board office. Thank you for being with us.
Good morning.
Good morning. They are both in our Spirit Square studio, and with us by phone is State Representative Charles Jeter, Republican from Huntersville, who has sponsored charter-related legislation and is the parent of three students at a Mooresville charter, Pine Lake Preparatory School. Welcome to the program, Representative.
Thanks for having me.
Charter schools have been with us, as I said, since 1996, over 20 years, or nearly 20 years. Do we know, do we have empirical evidence, all things being equal, that they perform better, on par with, or less than the public schools, traditional public schools? Do we know?
I think there's no really clear, simple answer. There are people who believe, as a matter of faith, that charters are great and public schools are dreadful and vice versa. But in fact, it's very much a school-by-school thing. Just as you can find outstanding schools and really struggling schools within Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools, within just the charter schools around here, we've seen some that have been quite successful, sometimes with the students who tend to be successful everywhere and sometimes with the students who tend to struggle. And we've obviously seen some pretty big charter school disasters here, too, schools that opened up and didn't get the enrollment and didn't really do much for their kids and then closed within the first year.
This is an old study now, I will grant you that, but according to a 2009 study conducted by Stanford University, charter schools perform about the same or worse than their traditional public school twins. So, but we don't know. We can't say that about what's happening here in Charlotte-Mecklenburg or about what's happening here in North Carolina at large, or do we?
You know, I love to run the numbers myself, and I have just found it really hard to do an apples-to-apples comparison, especially when you look at low-income and Black and Hispanic kids who are the ones that really struggle in CMS.
I think Ann's hit the nail on the head, which is it's not an apples-to-apples comparison. I mean, Mike, you started off the statement by saying all things being equal. The reality is all things aren't equal, and that's not necessarily between traditional public schools and charter schools, but I think that one of the growing pains of the growth of charter schools is what we've seen at some of these charter schools that haven't been successful. We probably have grown a little bit too much too fast, and I think that's something we have to look at the state level, because charter schools can be a great tool, and I think they can be a great asset to be part of the overall educational environment for our children. They're not the end-all, be-all. They're not the panacea, and we've got to be mindful that they shouldn't be, and they should never try to replace, and we shouldn't allow them to replace the traditional school model, which is so important to our communities. But I do think we got to look at how we weed out the bad actors from the good actors, because you look at Sugar Creek and Miss Turner School down there, you look at Pine Lake Prep, there are a lot of successful charter schools, but there's also failures. But that's also true in the traditional public school model as well.
Well, now, the state of North Carolina used to have a cap on the number of charter schools we could have. 100, I think, was the number. They removed the cap, and this year there are 160 charter schools in the state. What is driving the growth? Is it demand from parents? Is it people seeing, because a lot of these charter schools are for-profit organizations, is it companies seeing a way to make money? What's going on here?
I think it has to be a lot about demand from parents, because it really doesn't matter if the for-profit companies could see a way to make money but the children didn't show up, it wouldn't matter. So what we're seeing is that there's a serious demand. We have 1,399 kids this year in K through 10, and I still have about 300 kids on my waiting list.
Wow. Your school is the Sugar Creek Charter School. What's its mission? Why was it founded?
Our school
was, and when was it founded?
We were founded in 1999.
Okay.
And we focus on low-income students. We are 1,399 kids, but our population is 100% ethnic minority, 93% free and reduced lunch. And we our mission is to provide a quality education for every child by birthright.
And you've been in business since 1999, so tell me about your track record. How have you done?
We started out, we really were shaky going in. When I came in 2001.
That's a brave thing to say.
We were. And it's the challenge when you think about these bad ones. They were one of the bad ones. We were reporting extensively on how bad Sugar Creek was in the beginning.
When I came in 2001, the performance was 26.1%. We were shaky.
Okay.
And at one point, the state had voted to close us. We got 1 year to get better, and we were able to pull that off. Just before we changed to Common Core, we were at 80% proficiency. We're now back at about 62% proficiency with the new test. We tend to outperform similar schools to us by double digits.
And we need to mention that this changeover to these new tests, this has happened wherever they've gone in. It's not so much that the school has decreased in its performance, it's that the tests test differently.
Exactly.
And so it's an apples and oranges.
Yeah, year-to-year comparisons have become almost meaningless in North Carolina. So again, you try to does this school do the same or better than this school with the same population? And she's right. Her school tends to outperform the high-poverty neighborhood schools. Where you see a similar performance in CMS for poverty and for minorities is in the magnet schools. So again, there is some dynamic that has to do with families just choosing to get their kids somewhere else.
So, Representative Jeter, you said a moment or two that you have to be vigilant about this, and that perhaps we've allowed the numbers of these schools to grow too quickly. There are 160 right now. A number of organizations are still filing to open more charter schools in the future. The number of those filing has increased over time as well. What are the criteria for determining if a new charter is needed, if the organizers are qualified and able to deliver on their goals? Does the state have a set of things that they look at?
You know, it's all reviewed by the Charter School Advisory Board, which is under DPI, and then it goes to the ultimately for an approval process that's then recommended to the State Board of Education for final approval. I think the problem we've got is, let's take one piece of legislation that was filed this year of requiring a $50,000 bond, if you will. Historically, we've not required any of these schools to put up a bond to make sure that they had the financial resources necessary to, overcome the shortcomings is any new business. And let's be candid, charter schools are to some degree a business as well. They are funded with public funds, but they don't get capital funding. They don't get transportation funding. There's certainly other avenues that traditional public schools get that charter schools don't get. In return for that, charter schools get some flexibility that the traditional public schools don't. But that absence of capital funding has really caused a lot of the problems. And then to some degree, it's been, field of dreams analogy. We build it and they will come. I think Cheryl Turner's point is very accurate. I think for the vast majority of charter schools, it's all about parent and child choice, which I think we should encourage and go after. But there's no question that there are some schools that are opening up for business purposes and not educational purposes. The problem is it's easy to see that in hindsight. It's hard to see that looking forward. And we shouldn't throw out the baby for the bathwater. And that's my concern when we start talking about charter schools and some of those things. Yes, I think we've got to figure out a way to better vet these things. I think there's ways to improve that. But you also have to remember charter schools are an incredibly good tool. I filed a bill, 884, which became law in 2014, that takes a pilot charter school that takes traditional public school dropouts and puts them in charter school, later in the year, so we can get them graduated from high school. Those are the type of the things that charter schools do very, very well.
Now, we have 16 new charter schools in North Carolina, I believe, this year. Five of them are in Mecklenburg County. What are these new charter schools offering that other charter schools have not been offering or that the public schools are not offering?
Well, that's always the challenge because there's what they market. And I think it's four. I think there was one that was approved and withdrew, okay, or I've forgotten one. But there's a Queen City STEM school, which, of course, is science, technology, engineering, and math. Everybody and their cousin is offering STEM. It's a really important field. It may be done well or it may not. I know nothing about this one. Stewart Creek High in West Charlotte is targeting kids who have done poorly in high school who probably would drop out with some individualized learn-at-your-own-pace type stuff. Veritas in Uptown, the general Uptown area, is offering a focus on health and wellness as well as academics. And they have a quote, and I didn't bring my reading glasses, so I hope I can read it. Our goal is to make meals and movement as important as math and reading. So it will be very much focused on, I think, the academics, but also a health, nutrition type thing.
You also, at the Observer, charted out where, you mapped out where these charter schools are located.
I did. Should I hold it up for our listeners
to
see?
Put it up to the camera, and we'll show our listeners on the screen. But it's surprisingly, you were surprised by this.
I was, because I tend to see an address here and there, and I hadn't seen it on a map. And there's just really this cluster right through kind of the belt, what we would consider the urban belt, the uptown kind of southwest to northeast area, where the really struggling schools tend to be concentrated.
So they're not in the suburbs primarily.
There's kind of a little trail of charter school breadcrumbs going right up I-77 from, mm-hmm. you know, the north suburbs up to Statesville, and there's certainly a sprinkling in the southeast suburbs. But Cheryl raised the point that the location for a neighborhood district school location means that's where you're drawing from. For a charter school, not necessarily. They don't even have to come from within one county. So her take is that some of these that are located close in are maybe pulling the people who wouldn't go to a CMS school. And maybe you can elaborate on that.
Well, several of those schools, there, if you look at the diversity in their population, economically and racially, you'll find that they're not terribly diverse and they don't necessarily represent the students who live in the general area where they're located.
Okay.
And we actually got sidetracked. I mentioned three of the four. The fourth one, Charlotte Lab School, is the one that's really getting a lot of buzz. It is uptown. And it has a leader who is nationally known, and I think a lot of people who care about seeing good charter schools have said this is one to keep an eye on. They're talking, and everybody talks about creative project-based learning. Again, is it rhetoric or is it reality? But one of the things they're doing is their first graders will help design the school playground, and their fourth graders will help design the menu. They'll be learning about nutrition and costs and all things like that. So, and diversity is something that their founders have talked a lot about. It's, I think, and I'm pulling from Andrew Dunn's article, but looked like it was about 60% white and 40% minority, which does not exactly represent the district, but they're saying it's a start. That what they want is a real mix of economic and racial diversity.
You said a moment ago, Cheryl, that when you came to the school, it's essentially been on probation, your school, because you had 1 year to clean things up and make it work because it wasn't working.
That's correct.
And you're serving a population of young people who have struggled in school traditionally. When we come back from the break, what I'd like to hear you talk about is how you did it, how you turned it around, and what, if any, of the things that you did could be applied to the traditional public schools to do the same thing for their students who are also struggling. We got to take a break. We'll come right back with more in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFA. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Cat Wealth Consulting, LLC. Martha Cat is a financial advisor specializing in retirement planning for State of North Carolina employees. Online at cattwealth.com. The Charlotte Broadcast Hall of Fame is about to present its first inductees, and they include many of the pioneers of broadcasting in Charlotte, like Grady Cole, Charles Carrault, Betty Feaser, Doug Mays, Sis and Stan Kaplan, who created the groundbreaking station Big Ways that I mentioned, Larry Springle, and Chatty Hattie Leeper is on the list of the Hall of Fame inductees. We're going to hear about them all and talk to a few of them tomorrow, and then we'll hear about the 48-hour film festival, which is in town Thursday night. That's all tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Sentencing laws have been filling U.S. prisons with nonviolent drug offenders for decades. President Obama has made prison reform a priority in his remaining time in office, and there is bipartisan support. Proposals for criminal justice reform in the U.S.
At 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, here on WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about charter schools today. Ann Doss Helms is with us, the education reporter from the Charlotte Observer, Representative Charles Jeter, representative from Republican from Huntersville, who is a charter legislation sponsor in the legislature. These are difficult words for me today. And Cheryl Turner is director of the Sugar Creek Charter School and a member of the Charter Advisory Board. You mentioned a second ago in the conversation, Cheryl, that when you came to Sugar Creek Charter School, that you were struggling, the school was struggling, you had 1 year to turn it around. You have since done that. I'm wondering how you did it and what you've done that could be applied to traditional public schools.
Okay, I have to say that we didn't do anything. We didn't make up anything. I'd love to be brilliant enough to have designed something, but we really didn't. What we did is go out and look for best practices and then begin to implement them with fidelity. And anybody could do that. We looked at a group of schools that are called the 90-90-90 schools, and these are schools where 90% of the children are minority, 90% are free and reduced lunch, and 90% are at grade level. And we looked at what were the things those schools were doing, and then we proceeded to start to implement some of those.
What were they doing?
Things like climate and culture, a focus on climate and culture.
What does that mean?
Creating an environment that is an accepting environment for students. We work really hard. We're a highly structured school. So our kids walk in lines. They wear uniforms. I mean, it's a very highly structured environment. But we really work at creating a family atmosphere. We worked at creating an environment where it was cool to be smart. That was not the case when I first got there. We had to work at that. We do that with incentives. We do it with creating with mentors and that kind of stuff. So we worked on that. We teach character ed as a core subject in our school. And so we worked on teaching our students how to interact with each other, how to handle themselves in what we call the climate for work and school, which may not be the same as how you handle yourself in your own neighborhood. And then we started to work on academics. We set a goal to be a 90-90-90 school. The staff focused on that. We did a lot of staff development. We do about 150 hours of staff development a year. So it was a concentrated effort on the things that work.
But now you have parents who were motivated enough to enroll their children in your school. You have parents who are motivated enough to go out and buy the uniforms that these kids have to wear to school. Does that help? In other words, you have the parents on your side. And I hear a lot from public school teachers that the parents are not necessarily on their side. They're on Johnny's side and Susie's side.
That actually probably is just parents. We have typical parents. I have to say that obviously they found us someplace. But the kinds of things you hear from everybody, that's the same kinds of things we see. We have some parents who are right there, highly supportive. And then we have some parents we never see. We have almost 70% of our kids live with someone other than their biological parent.
Okay.
Mostly grandparents. So, I mean, we have the full gamut. We, and our parents, because of the type of work they do, are hourly employees, tend to be hourly employees. They can't spend a whole bunch of time at school. So we really focus more on what we call parental support rather than parental involvement.
So how much of what you have done and what you demand of your students and the kinds of things that you teach them, like character education, could be adopted by the public schools? Or would there be a hue and cry in the public schools, like walking in line and wearing uniforms and things like that?
I don't think so. We don't get a lot of pushback from parents about the uniforms. They actually, in the end, turned out to be cheaper than having to buy clothes. And because we're in uniform, we don't get a lot of the interaction between kids about their shoes and all that kind of stuff. The walking in lines, when people come into our building, one of the things they always comment on is how quiet it is in our building. And you walk around the classrooms and kids are engaged in instruction everywhere you go. I don't think there's any parent that would think that was a bad thing.
Okay. And I would say that what she's saying is what everybody says. And their CMS schools are doing these things, sometimes successfully and sometimes not. The part that she left out about fixing Sugar Creek was that they started with a for-profit management company, and not a blanket indictment of them, but when it was not doing well, that's who they had. The local board got rid of that company and hired Cheryl. And the consistent thing that I see in schools that beat the odds is a school leader, a principal who is really good at it. And everybody can say it, and not everybody can do it, and that's the real challenge of mass-producing school reform.
Representative Jeter, one of the things that you said earlier, it was interesting to hear, actually, because I've heard from others that they believe that the modus operandi in the legislature is to end public schools and replace them with these charter schools. And you said that we need to support both, and we certainly don't want to lose the traditional public schools. And I've had administrators of public schools tell me that they're actually looking at these charter schools to see what works in the hopes that perhaps they can find something that works that they could adopt. But sometimes they can't because of the rules and regulations that they have to follow that the charter schools do not. Is the legislature and the Board of Education open to changing those rules if we find something that really works in the charters and we'd like to put it into the public school system?
Well, I will say, first of all, I think it's just, and I know you're not saying it, but you're repeating, I think, a common theme that somehow there's this belief to try to kill traditional public schools, and I just categorically disagree with that. Traditional public schools have to be and will continue to be the salad, the main course, and everything to the dinner. Charter schools should just be the dessert, and any effort to undo that, I will staunchly oppose. Going to the second part of your question, when charter schools were first presented, I think originally in Minnesota some 20-some-odd years ago, and in North Carolina was one of the newer states or soon states after that, it was designed to be an incubator of ideas. So I think one of the things that a lot of people in a lot of states have not capitalized on as much, and I think we've got to find a way to do it more, is how do we take what Ms. Turner is doing so well at Sugar Creek? How do we take what Mr. Terrell is doing so well at Pine Lake Prep? How do we take those good ideas that are working so well to capture students' imaginations and talents that for whatever reason haven't been captured before and translate that and transition that to our traditional public schools? I mean, that's the goal. And it's to some degree, it's a $64,000 question. If it was that easy to figure out how to do it, we'd have done it by now.
You have three students. Your three children are in Pine Lake.
My daughter starts high school this morning, so that makes me feel a little older than I'd like.
And they're at Pine Lake Prep. What do they do? What do they do that made you want to choose that school for your children?
I always think it's interesting that people think I had a choice. I've been happily married for 15 years by saying yes, ma'am, whenever my wife tells me what's going on. When I live in Huntersville, and at the time that my oldest daughter, who starts ninth grade today, was going into, she was at kindergarten at Torrance Creek, and as Ann can probably remember, mm-hmm. at that time, Torrance Creek Elementary was the most overpopulated elementary school in the state of North Carolina. Bradley Middle was the most overpopulated middle school in the state of North Carolina. North Meck and Hopewell were two of the most overcrowded high schools in the state of North Carolina. So when Pine Lake opened, we made the choice predominantly because of the overcrowding issues in the northern suburbs. I say we because I was there, but it is a decision my wife and I made, and it worked out well for us. I'm sure there's plenty of cases where it doesn't, but the real reason we moved was because of overcrowding. And I think that if you look back at the late 90s, early 2000s, mid 2000s, that was a real problem in the suburbs, and you saw a lot of these charter schools, Community School of Davidson, and other things pop up. I think what we're seeing now is more of what the original intent of the legislation of charter school initiation was, which is what Ms. Turner's doing at Sugar Creek.
If there was overcrowding, and there certainly was, that's a budget problem, it seems to me, that calls out for a need for more schools. And if we truly believe in the traditional public school model, why didn't the state simply come up with more money instead of essentially taking money from the existing public schools and giving it to charter schools for operational expenses? There is this criticism that although these competitive schools may spur public schools on to compete, they may not be able to compete because they don't have as much money as they used to have because it's going to the charter schools.
Well, I think that's a fair criticism. I mean, I wasn't in the state legislature then, so I can't, go to that point. I think that you got to remember charter schools don't get capital funding. So on a per pupil basis, charter schools are less expensive to educate our children than the traditional public school model is. Now, there's no question that there is money that follows that child. And there's an ongoing debate, fair or unfair. I think it's a fair argument that are we more concerned about the institutions or are we more concerned about the children? I would argue there's people at Miss Turner School. I would argue there's people at Pine Lake. I would argue there's people at all kind of charter schools that a traditional school model wouldn't have served. But the traditional school model serves 80-90% of our children incredibly effectively, and we have to maintain that. And not only do we have to maintain it, we have to increase it, and we have to make sure it is funded. I mean, you look at the bond packages, you look at the things we've done in education, I think, in the legislature in the last 3 years, we've actually increased spending contrary to popular belief. We've tried to do the right things. I know anytime you deal with education, it's controversy. There's two committees I never wanted to serve on: education and environment, because all you do is make people less mad with the good decisions. And I think we've got to find the happy mix. Going to your point, I think we've got to find a way to have a better vetting process on these charter schools. I oppose virtual charters. I'm not a big fan of the concept of taking over public schools and converting them to charters. I think that I appreciate Representative Bryan's imaginative and creative ideas. I think he's no question his heart's in the right place. He's a smart guy. He cares about education. I have some heartburn over that issue. I have a heartburn over the issue of changing the oversight of the advisory board of charter schools from DPI to the Board of Education. Which is why I made the motion not to concur with that on the House floor a couple weeks ago. So I think we've got to look at, and to some degree we do this bad, and it's not just Republicans or Democrats. Every legislative body does it. We like to do things in patches. We need to look at the whole quilt and say, okay, let's look at education policy in this state. What is the right mix? What are we looking at from a homeschooling perspective, from a charter school perspective, from a traditional public school? What can we do to make sure that these things can really be incubators? And I think one of the things that we forget, we talk about the presidential race, we talk about the U.S. Senate race, we talk about the gubernatorial races, as we should. But one of the most important jobs in this state, which I think goes underreported and underappreciated, is the role of DPI. And what June Atkinson's role is, and no one knows what June's doing. I think someone like Representative Tricia Cotham, who's been an incredible, valuable asset to education, is somebody that I think could be a real breath of fresh air in that job, and could look at something that would be a way to look at the education policy as a whole instead of trying to do it as one-offs. Because when you do it as one-offs, you do create unintended inequities.
Well, I'm going to come back to some of the things you talked about going on in the legislature with regard to education and charter schools and DPI, et cetera, in the next segment. But, Ann, in Charlotte, there are 25 charter schools, by my count, maybe 24, siphoning off about $30 million. That's from the public schools. That's 2% of their budget, of their annual $1.4 billion budget. It's $8 million, however, more than last year. Is there a way to gauge the impact of the loss of that $30 million on CMS?
I think it's really hard to do because they are also not having those students there. So in sort of the theory of it is that you have X amount of pie to distribute to the Mecklenburg County public school students, and charter schools are a form of public schools. So if they take 2% of the students, they get 2% of the pie. Clearly CMS, I think the bigger challenge for them is planning, because it's sort of a challenge within CMS. You sometimes have a school that they thought they were going to have one number of students, and it turns out higher or lower. But with the charters, you see even more of that. And in particular, if you have a charter that opens and then closes, then And in any case, when a student decides or is forced to decide that this is not the right place for them, they come back to the public schools. And sometimes they come back having had not a very good experience right. for most of the year.
And the public schools have to take everybody.
They do.
Charter
yeah.
schools don't, right?
Well, that's not exactly true.
Okay.
The schools are open to all students across the state. And if you get more applications than you have space, you have to use a lottery. So we really have no control over who our students are.
Okay.
So that part's not true. The other thing I wanted to come back to is this idea that somehow charters are exempt from all these regulations. I want to know what those regulations are because they just aren't there. The only thing that I can, particularly now, from 97 to now, we have been included in so much of the legislation that we really aren't exempt from that much stuff. The biggest thing that I can see that I have that maybe a principal in a traditional school wouldn't have is that my employees are at will. And so I have more control over who works for me. But other than that,
And the calendar bill.
And
I think that's a small but symbolic thing. And, you know, there are a few things that I think are easy in public education, but I have never heard a good compelling argument for why the state tells school districts when they have to open and close schools. That just seems like a no-brainer. Give everybody that flexibility.
And Ann Dock Towns is, as usual, 100% correct on this point. My good friend Rhonda Lennon, who's killing me on Facebook over this issue yesterday and today. And I love Rhonda to death. But, the calendar flexibility issue is, to me, it's more than symbolic. It's a real issue that we need to fix. The House has passed the bill. We passed it in 2011. We passed it in 2013. We didn't pass it this year only because we knew it wouldn't go anywhere in the Senate. The reality is the Senate chamber in this building has decided that they are not passing that. I don't understand it. It defies logic to me. It's a simple fix. It's something we need to do. We fought hard for it. I was the primary sponsor of the legislation in 2013. I think it's critically important. But based on the makeup of the Senate right now, it gets sent to the Ways and Means Committee. And the Senate, bills that get sent to rules go to die. Bills that get sent to Ways and Means, they're there to torture those bills. I mean, they're not dead. I mean, it's a whole different level of pain over there at Ways and Means. Literally, Ways and Means hasn't met in 13 years in the Senate. So if a bill goes there, it's like going into the black hole at the center of the Milky Way. It's not coming out.
One of the things that the public schools struggle with, and I only have a minute left in this segment, is the fact that the calendar, the budget calendars are out of whack with the legislature's budget calendars, and this year particularly so because the legislature hasn't passed a budget yet for the state, which leaves the schools in limbo. That affects the public schools. Does it also affect the charter schools?
It actually affects us more because we don't have the same amount of capital to carry us while they figure out how much money we're going to get. So it affects charters even more than it does the districts.
Any possibility that might adjust itself over time, Representative, in 20 seconds or less?
Yes.
How's that for a quick answer?
That was about five-tenths of a second. We have to take a break. We're going to come back and talk more about charter schools and also about some of the things that are going on in House Senate committees that may affect charter schools going forward. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Griffin Brothers Tire, Wheels, and Auto Repair. Family-owned, serving the greater Charlotte area since 1961. 10 convenient locations featuring tire and automotive repair. Details at griffinbrothers.com. Sentencing laws have been filling U.S. prisons with nonviolent drug offenders for decades, and President Obama has made reform a priority in his remaining time in office. There's also bipartisan support for this. So on the Diane Rehm Show at 10 o'clock, they'll talk about proposals for criminal justice reform in the United States. That's coming up in 20 minutes. If you'd like to join our conversation about charter schools, now's the time. Email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. We're coming right back.
There are career-defining moments in all of our lives, but not all of them involve powerful politicians.
I said, I'm not feeling it. And Hillary Clinton just lifted her face to me, and she said, "And do what you feel, Chris."
I'm Kai Rizdahl. They also, by the way, don't normally involve red lipstick. We'll tell you more next time on Marketplace from APN.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE. Listener-funded public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about charter schools today with Ann Doss Helms, the education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Cheryl Turner is the director of the Sugar Creek Charter School and a member of the Charter Advisory Board. And Representative Charles Jeter is a Republican from Huntersville in the legislature, in the House. He's also a charter legislation sponsor. Let me share with you some of the things that have been coming in on Facebook, Twitter, et cetera, as we've been talking, because we put a social media question out there earlier today. Are charter schools making a difference in public education? Frank writes, the difference in a charter school and a public school is that when a charter school fails, it is closed. The public school continues to operate and continues to fail. Something to be said for that.
Yeah, but I think it's an unfair. I mean, to me, this is the problem, and I'm probably guilty of it as too, but this is the problem with political discussions. We use sound bites, and when we're talking about educating our children, it's just not as simplistic as saying a school's failed and shut it down and do all these things. To me, these are young children that we have a responsibility as a community to try to make sure we educate to the best of their abilities, to the best of our abilities. And, I'm guessing, and I don't have the stats, but I'm guessing the percentage of schools that have failed is probably a similar percentage between charters and public schools. And I don't think it's fair to label either branch or either aspect of traditional public schools as one that is failing, because they both have different attributes. They both are part of the puzzle, and we need to get away from pointing fingers at each other and figure out how we can work together.
And yet the state is putting letter grades on schools, including F letter grades, which some charter schools here have gotten them and some public schools here have gotten them.
And I'm not a fan of that. And I agree with you. I mean, to me, I'm not a fan of that necessarily either. I mean, I understand that you want – I mean, I understand the desire of letting schools have some sort of – metric to grade their performance by that is clearer than charts and graphs with SAT scores and ACT scores and whatever, all the testing, end of grade testing scores and all that kind of stuff. I think we probably went too far in the simplistic model. I was obviously one of the ones this year that did not want to go to the 10-point scale and keep it to the 15-point scale, because I think there's real merit in the concern that you don't want to brand a school with an F or a D, because it does have a tendency, or it can have a tendency, to become a self-fulfilling prophecy. And from that reason, I think we've got to take a better look at that.
But getting back to Frank's point, if you give a public school an F, then unless the parents have options, they're going to leave their kids there because they have to put them in school. If you give a charter school an F, they're likely to close their doors because the parents will flee. So he has a point about public schools staying open even if they're failing.
But I think the real question about school reform is not how do you label or punish the school or the adults, because that's almost the mindset, is that, they weren't trying hard enough, so zing, do something to them. The real question is the kids who were not doing well in that school, can they do better somewhere else? And are you getting them that better opportunity? And that's a whole different question.
Let me ask you a question, Cheryl, about this, because a lot of people a lot of teachers are upset about being graded on the performance of their students, over which their lives they have no control. And a lot of these students come from terrible household situations that prevent them from learning. They weren't read to as a child. They go home to a one-parent or a no-parent household. It's not a pleasant atmosphere. There's no time to study. Education is not valued, etc. How are you successful when the public schools are not?
Well, one of the things that – and I just did a State of the School thing with our staff, and one of the things I talk about consistently is we don't want to set ourselves up to base things on the things we can't change.
So is it fair to test – to grade teachers to put their pay schedule based on performance in the classroom by students whose lives they can't control?
I don't know that I think it – if on proficiency, I don't think it's fair. On growth, I do think it's fair. I think it is fair to expect that a child will get a minimum of 1 year's growth for 1 year showing up in school. And we go for a year and a half. And I do think that teachers add value, and that can be measured, and that you should be evaluated on how much value you add.
You're a member, speaking of evaluations, you're a member of the Charter Advisory Board, which I believe was created in 2013 to replace a previous board. And one of the criticisms of the Charter Advisory Board is that it's made up of charter supporters. You run a charter school. You're on the board. Is that a good idea?
Okay, let me first correct. I rolled off in June.
Okay. But you were on the board.
For 3 years. So I was on the original council, and then I was also on the board. I think that charter schools are difficult to understand. They are businesses, and yet you're still running. You have the whole educational program. You have to have people who know charters to make those kind of decisions, because people who aren't in that environment don't understand some of the implications of things that just don't happen in regular public schools.
But we have public school boards of people who are lawyers and doctors and homemakers and whatever they happen to be in their real occupation, making decisions for experts who have built their lives around teaching and administering schools.
And it doesn't always work all that well.
Okay. Interesting. I'll go back to some of our Facebook and Twitter comments. Representative Jeter mentioned he's opposed to online charters. David wants to know why, and could Andos Helms explain what they are and how they work? There are two online charters right now, as I understand this, right, Representative?
I believe you're correct. I think, you know, when it comes to our children, hands-on, eyeball-to-eyeball, face-to-face education is the model that has worked in this country for hundreds of years, whether it be homeschool, whether it be private school, whether it be charter school, whether it be traditional public school. When you get a child in a virtual charter, to me, it's a bridge too far for me.
So how do they work, Ann?
Well, I'm borrowing heavily from my colleague at the News and Observer, Lynn Bonner, who's done a piece on them. I'm just kind of getting up to speed on these also. But you can enroll from anywhere around the state, and they have a cap of 1,500 students each. There are two of them. Each of them are run by a big for-profit corporation. One of them is K-12, and one of them is Pearson. And the one that I reached said that they have – that's Connections Academy – said that they have about 400 students enrolled from the greater Charlotte region, almost 200 of them Mecklenburg County.
So they sit at their computers?
You are basically homeschooled. And parents, especially in the early grades, have to sign on to do a lot of monitoring and a lot of interaction. So one thing that's not clear to me is whether this is an additional support to people who are already homeschooling, or sort of who's going to be in this mix. But they send books and materials and things like that, apparently. And this child is working at home, and the teachers, in one case, the teachers are working from their homes, according to Lynn's article, and in another case, they're going to an office in Durham, and they'll be broadcast out, and I'm sure they'll have a lot of the ways of interacting that we all do if you do a webinar or that kind of thing. They have not had a spectacularly successful record in a lot of other states, and in fact, it's funny when we talk about charter school supporters, just from this hour, you can hear there's a lot of difference of opinion just with Cheryl and Charles, who are both charter school supporters, and a lot of the charter school supporters in North Carolina said, no, we don't want to open this door, and others from the legislature came in and said, yes, we will. So it's on a four-year trial period now.
Donald, on our website, writes, would you please make the point that charter schools are not private schools? We are public schools. I don't think we ever said that, but okay, we've said that they're public schools, but there are not any religious charter schools. We are as non-sectarian as any public school. Our families do not pay tuition. We do have to do a lot of fundraising since we don't get funding for facilities, but we are not private schools. Has anybody said that they're private schools?
No, we haven't. Okay. And I laugh a little bit about that line just because I hear it a lot, that charter schools are public schools, and it's mostly true. Although when I found that I asked for their salaries, like other public schools have to disclose, and, you know, both Cheryl and Charles kind of fought me on that in different ways. Charles actually was on kind of both sides of that issue at different times. Cheryl flat out fought turning them over. So they are public schools. They don't always want to be as public as sometimes we reporters think public schools ought to be.
Well, and going to Ann's point, I'm coachable if nothing else. And you know, I think that there is merit in having, and I maintain this on the teaching on the pricing, or excuse me, the salary requirements on teachers. I think there's merit in having teacher salaries released from traditional public schools to charter public schools to satisfy the Facebook poster. You know, what I don't necessarily think is, I don't think in either model, traditional public or charter schools, that having the actual teacher's name attached to that salary provides any real value. Now, we're talking about gender. We're talking about all the other identifying issues to see if there's discrepancies, and I think that makes a lot of sense. But the fact that a fourth grader can look up what their teacher makes in any environment, to me, I don't know the newsworthiness of it. The fact that a parent can look up what a fourth grade teacher with X number of years, gender, and all the requirements to make sure everyone's on the up and up, to me, that's a separate issue.
Can they do that in the public schools? Can they do it in the University of North Carolina system?
To my knowledge right now, and Ann, correct me if I'm wrong, you can look up a teacher's name. I mean, all the information is public on.
Yeah, they're basically available if we request it and post it, which
well,
we have.
If they're available in the public, and these are in the public sphere, and these are public schools, why wouldn't what's good for the goose be good for the gander?
My argument is it's not good for either to release the names. The rest of the information, I'll give you a prime example. Under the public's disclosure requirements, you don't have to release gender with salary. That's not one of the criteria under state law. So what good does it give if you're trying to figure out if there's discrimination in pay at the public school level, if you're trying to figure out all these things, not knowing gender? There's no nepotism clause. You don't have to disclose any relational family relationships between people. I mean, to me, and look, the charter schools had to disclose it. I mean, ultimately they fought it, but eventually they had to do it. That was the decision made by the state. But to me, that whole issue needs to be looked at, because I understand what Ann and the journalists want, and I think they deserve that information, obviously. But having a person's name assigned to it is not as important to me as giving them the information to make sure that we're doing everything above board across the state, across all public schools.
And I agree for the most part that there's very limited value in the names of rank-and-file people.
Mm-hmm.
The value is, though, that you can look and see if there is something, you know, I have heard at certain charter schools, for instance, that, oh, all the board members have put their family members on staff and they're being paid, you know, as assistants or whatever. If there's just, you know, assistant A or teacher B, don't know who they are.
And that I agree with you, but right now you wouldn't know if it was their sister-in-law.
No, but if it's if it's posted, then somebody is going to look at that and be able to say, I know there's these connections.
And there's a problem with that, one would think, on the surface. And then there's a problem also with people, we're giving tax dollars to public corporations, private corporations, public corporations who are for-profit corporations running schools. Isn't that kind of strange, that tax dollars go to
Mike, I think that's a misnomer, because we give tax dollars to for-profit water and sewer companies that put in our water and sewer lines. We give tax dollars to people to run our prisons. We give tax dollars to people to build our roads. The concept that we only give tax dollars to for-profit private education, it's just not based in reality.
And school districts pay huge amounts to corporations that are providing materials.
I don't want to run out of time before we have a chance to talk about the legislature and what's going on there. Why did the legislature introduce legislation to remove charter schools from the oversight of the Department of Public Instruction?
That was in the infinite wisdom of the Senate, and I've been here 3 years, and I've yet to figure it out.
Well, the House rejected the measure. The Senate likes it. Explain the difference in the two bodies.
One uses logic and the other doesn't.
Cheryl was kind of helping me understand that earlier on before you came in.
Well, let me ask you this. What's the difference between taking it from the Department of Public Instruction and moving it to the oversight of the Board of Education? What's the difference?
I think that, you know, from a functional difference, I'm not sure there really is a difference. You know, there is a belief that there is a conflict or a tension between DPI and charter schools for a lot of the reasons that we've discussed in this program. Are we taking money away from traditional public schools to give to charter public schools and some of those issues? And you know, I think from that perspective, you know, I think the argument is let's separate them so they don't have that internal friction. I think from an operational perspective, there's problems because you're still going to have the staffing. You're still going to have a lot of the functions of the operational functionality is going to be within DPI. And to me, I think it goes back to the point, if we look at education as a whole versus in this patchwork, I think we can solve the problem without rearranging chairs on the ship of the boat.
Meanwhile, one of your colleagues, Representative Rob Bryan, Republican from Mecklenburg, is pushing a bill that would pull five of the state's lowest performing elementary schools out of their local districts and put them into a state-controlled achievement school district. The bill would allow this new district to hire and fire teachers and staff and enter into five-year contracts with charter school companies to handle school operations. That bill's in a House Senate conference committee that you are on. What do you think of that bill and why?
I think that it is, I think Rob Bryan is certainly a leader in the education field. Here's a guy who went and taught in the inner city schools in Los Angeles as part of Teach for America. I mean, this is someone who's walked the walk. I'm trying to learn more about it. It is a complicated issue. I'm not sure of the end transfer, what happens if and when the charter school operators is able to make it a successful program. Is it then transferred back to the traditional public school? I think there's a lot of questions. I think it's something that we need to make sure we vet. To be candid, and I don't know why I say that because Ann will tell you I'm always candid, I'm usually not one for a lack of opinion either. On this one, I'm really trying to do my research and make sure we make the right decision because this is a significant change for education, and it's something that we've got to take very seriously.
Representative Charles Jeters, Republican from Huntersville and charter legislation sponsor. He's on that House Senate Conference Committee that's dealing with a lot of these issues right now in Raleigh. Cheryl Turner is director of the Sugar Creek Charter School and a member of the Charter, or former member of the Charter Advisory Board. And Andos Helms is the longtime education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins.